Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
In the year 1006, a star exploded. Visible for 3 years, it was observable worldwide from China to the Americas and is widely regarded as the brightest supernova in human history. But there's something odd in the record of this event. It was far less noted in Europe than elsewhere, especially in the East, for it wasn't merely an explosion. It marked the first time in memory that the nighttime sky, the firmament, changed. And so, in spite of the fact that this was, in many cases, an event that was unifying, we all, after all, live under the same stars, it was perceived differently. This perception was colored by the worldview of the observer, that is, the extent to which a culture embraced change or permanence, certainty or the unknown. The resistance to change is not surprising. Our world is filled with uncertainty, and this can be terrifying. For our earliest ancestors, the chaos beyond community, culture, and kinship could mean death. So they created not merely a space for physical safety, but also a culture that proffered the emotional security that comes from creating symbols and stories, a cosmology, which means both beauty and order, that give us a sense of place in the world, that give our lives meaning. This is humanity's sociocultural expression of what biologists call Umwelt, what each species can perceive based on its sensory bubble. Every species is limited by its senses. Humans, for instance, cannot see certain colors that birds can, but the Umwelt is always experienced as all-encompassing. So too is this true of human culture, symbolic and mythic worlds we construct. The world that most human cultures constructed was a dance between cosmos and chaos, certainty and the unknown, change and permanence. These three things, uncertainty, impermanence, and powerlessness, lie at the heart of this collective, global, teachable moment. We cannot know certainty or control powerlessness, our world, because it is inherently relational and in flux, impermanence. Each moment is pregnant with possibility and potential, fraught with danger and mystery. Paradoxically, it is when we can be at ease with uncertainty, and we can accept our own powerlessness, we become free.
I'm joined today by Finn Schubert, who's a writer and public health professional who's fascinated by narrative in all its forms. He's the author of Even the Cemeteries Have Space Here, an essay collection exploring themes of fertility, grief, and place, and he currently writes a newsletter titled The Menstruant, with weekly essays exploring the question, what does it mean to be a gay man who loves having a uterus? Finn's career in public health has included working to increase access to contraceptive options in rural family health centers, to improve equity in HIV care and prevention services, and to roll out healthcare services focused on the needs of the LGBTQ+ community. He previously served on the board of Sadie Nash Leadership Project and currently serves on the board of Wisdom Projects. Finn Schubert, welcome to Reimagining.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So kind of wanted to start, I think today we're going to talk a lot about your own experiences in healthcare and the kind of broader implications of those experiences. But I'd like to kind of start with you and just a little about your background and hear how you got to where you are, both personally and professionally. And so I guess I'll start with a question that you posed in your work, which is, what does it mean to be a gay man who loves having a uterus?
Yes, I think that's a great question. And it has fueled many essays over the course of months. So I'm not sure that I'm all the way to the bottom of that. But I will tell you that the reason that I chose to title my newsletter this way and focus it in this way is actually that for my whole life, I was kind of taught that these two narratives were in opposition. You could either love having a uterus or you could be a gay man. You could love maybe being a trans man, but you had to be like, oh, I'm not comfortable with this part of my body, or I'm not going to talk about that. And I wanted to claim that intersection. So that's why I called this the menstruant, because that always felt like my ability to have a uterus or to menstruate really set me apart from other gay men. and to kind of instead dive into that intersection of what does it mean to be a gay man who loves having a uterus. Now, my choice to relaunch my newsletter like this coincided pretty closely with my public announcement of my pregnancy. I was probably early in my second trimester of pregnancy, and now I could be giving birth basically any day now. So I will try not to go into labor on our podcast, but
I was just going to ask you if you could just wait until the end of our conversation. That'd be great. But, or maybe
I'll see what I can do.
Actually, though, that'd be kind of cool. So
it would be. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I think what I found was that there were so many different conversations to have, because on one hand, we're talking about cultural misogyny. On one hand, we're talking about what we as a culture think that it means to be trans. Since I'm pregnant right now, I look at what do we as a culture think that it means to be pregnant? What do we as a culture tell ourselves about gay men or about queer or gay history? So there are so many different angles, and that's why it's been such a, to put it one way, a fertile project.
I love that. Is there a way in which, I mean, surely you're received in a different way as a trans man being pregnant. I mean, you know, asking the question about your, what is your place in the world? Do you feel like there's a special kind of wisdom that you have because you are coming at pregnancy in such a unique way, and or a way that's not conventional in our civilization? Is, you know, because you brought up the question of what does it mean to be trans? So I'd like you to say a little more about that. And in relation to your pregnancy, what do you feel is, or maybe there's nothing unique about it to you, or maybe it's the same. What do you think is the particular perspective that you gain from your vantage point as a trans man?
I think that there are basically two narratives about trans men being pregnant. One is, you know, let's say nobody thinks that we exist at all, or if we exist, it's like big news. And then the other one being that this must be very difficult because of this idea that being trans means that we don't like match. And for some people, that's their truth. For me, I feel like I match being a trans person perfectly fine. And so what it has given me is the ability to navigate systems and stories from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. So because I don't see myself in stories about pregnancy, whether those be the ads that are constantly trying to sell me essentially an idealized version of pregnant womanhood, I'm just like, oh, well, I'm not going to get sucked into that. That's not me. But also what we tell ourselves about what it is to be pregnant more generally, like, how do I expect to feel? How do I expect to be treated? And one thing that I have been reflecting on a lot is our cultural narratives about visibility and invisibility. So as a pregnant person, I tend to be fairly invisible. You know, people might notice my body shape, but right, they don't notice that I'm pregnant. So they're not going to come up to me and give me unsolicited advice, which I've come to understand happens a lot to cisgender women who are pregnant. Sure. And that gives me a lot of freedom, right? It's kind of like an invisibility cloak in a way, because I don't have to be fending off strangers when some of my friends who are pregnant are, that's a big part of their pregnancy experience. So sometimes I find this invisibility empowering, but at the same time, I think culturally we're often told like visibility is the key to liberation or towards social justice. And I think there's certainly something to that as well. So kind of playing with like, when am I seen? When am I not seen? When do I want to be seen? When do I not want to be seen? When am I reflected? Or what does being reflected as a pregnant trans man feel like? And when am I not? When do I want or need to be reflected? And when is that not so important to me so that I can turn inward? Those are all things that have been extremely interesting to me at this time.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're speaking more broadly to the question about, and I think we'll dive into this more a little later too in our conversation, you're touching on what's always been a big area of exploration for me, which is the kind of assumptions and deep narratives that we hold on to, and how, on the one hand, when something doesn't fit into that narrative, it's very hard for us at times to perceive or even acknowledge its existence when it doesn't fit into our narrative. And on the other hand, the power that lies in being able to see something beyond the narratives that we've been given, right? And so that's, and I think that's a lot of your work and a lot of your reflections have to do with that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I see narrative as a container in the sense of, you know, you have the water, you can pour it into different containers, but if you don't realize that that's kind of how it works, then you are stuck in one container and you can't even see that you're stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. You know, and so much, you know, I think we're living in a rich moment when there's an opportunity to see beyond those. I've described it as an apocalyptic moment when the world, not the world physically necessarily, but the worldview that we've constructed through narrative is kind of coming to a conclusion and something new is being birthed in a way, to use that metaphor. So I'd like to kind of dive into, because you have a unique perspective in another way, in that you are a healthcare professional who is engaging in the system in a way in which, and we're talking about the ways in which you are not, maybe are not seen or not, or you're not able to fit into those kind of boxes that the healthcare system has already in place. What has that been like? Have there been struggles? Have there been challenges? What has it been like engaging with a healthcare system?
Yeah. And first I want to really talk about what a healthcare system is, because I think that culturally, even though we're aware that healthcare is a large system, there's a narrative that really focuses on the provider-patient relationship. And I've been a patient. I'm not a healthcare provider. I'm a public health professional. I'm a program manager. And I currently work at Bergen Newbridge Medical Center rolling out LGBTQ programs. And I've also been a health professional and a researcher. So I've taught research methods. I've published articles on various aspects of public health and clinical care. And because I work in these different roles, it's my job to understand things about healthcare systems. I have to understand how insurance works. I have to understand where healthcare research comes from and whether or not it's good research. I have to understand regulatory and compliance issues. And so we end up in a very complex ecosystem. And the reason that I'm making a point of this is because I have found that often a conversation about trans health focuses on the provider-patient relationship. And so it's like, well, if only the provider used better language or the provider was more educated. And I'm sitting here as a public health professional saying, why wasn't the provider educated? We need to look at the residency education standards. We need to look at the regulatory standards. We need to look at compliance issues. We need to look at what the expectations are in terms of insurers. And I have to wonder why so much of healthcare is reduced to a patient-provider relationship when we all know that how we're treated at the front desk matters, how much we're charged matters. And so I've always thought to broaden that conversation in that way. And so interestingly, as a pregnant person, I was able to choose providers that I feel very comfortable with. But what happened was my insurance wouldn't pay for anything because I'm legally male. And that has been a fairly lengthy situation to sort out. And I think that has kind of expanded what I see as health equity, or what I see as how these conversations need to look, that we always need to be looking at a systems perspective and not sort of the individual provider patient perspective.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What doesn't make sense is why it's so hard for you to get this care. And this is maybe a question from someone who's very much not that immersed in the healthcare system and doesn't know how these things work entirely. Is there not any allowance in our systems for a person to be legally male and also and trans and have a uterus and have this be pregnant? Is there nothing kind of in place for that to happen?
So interestingly, I did get to the bottom of this after months. There are certain things in place for this, which my insurer did not tell me about. I had to go through a number of different advocacy groups. I would say that even though I work in healthcare, I had to ask over a dozen professional contacts for help with this issue. before I could even start to get anywhere with how to address it, which was incredibly surprising to me. And I truly do not know what someone would have done if they were starting from a place where they did not have as much background with this issue.
Yeah.
And so that feels very disturbing to me. But one thing that has come up for me in general is that as someone who's a binary identified trans man, I just updated all my IDs many years ago. Like I practically forgot about it.
Yeah.
And for years, this wasn't an issue. Like I would fly on airplanes, I would show my ID, whatever. And that's a reflection of a certain amount of passing privilege and other types of privileges. But I will say, like, for years, I just didn't think about it. And then when I started to require a lot of care related to my pregnancy, I would get these denials from my insurance company. And they would say, like, patient sex or gender doesn't match the procedure code. And I called them and they told me that the only way to get my care covered would be that my provider would have to do what's called like a peer-to-peer, where they talk to another provider and a provider from the insurance company to review it, or I would have to appeal every single claim. And, you know, that didn't sound quite right, but I continued on. And then a provider who was reviewing this like routine ultrasound that I needed done said that he would not approve it unless he saw an original copy of my birth certificate, which in fact I don't have. I found this incredibly bizarre because this is like an ultrasound showing that I have a pregnant uterus and like everyone who's pregnant needs to get this particular ultrasound. And they were just like, no, like clearly somebody is mistaken or confused. And so what I found was that there was a lot of this idea all of a sudden that like, okay, you're trans, you're pregnant, so you must like really be female. Like you were mistaken that your IDs only say male. And during this period of time, I tried to book travel to a conference through a travel agency that I was required to use. And I told them that I was pregnant because it impacted which flights I was willing to take. And they said, and I said, but I am legally male. I need you to put male on the ticket because that's what it says on my ID. And they didn't. They put female. And so I realized like suddenly like nobody believes me about what it says on my own ID. Right. And that was very interesting because I felt like suddenly there was this idea that was being explained to me by all of these people, like from the insurance company that was like, okay, well, you identify as male, but you're really female. And I'm like, you know, that's an ontological conversation. We can have different opinions about that. But at the end of the day, like I'm a competent adult who knows what it says on my ID. And I can't give you an ID that says female. And so that really showed me this cultural construction of transness that I didn't realize was in play, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Surely in some cases, there is transphobia, let's just call it, like in some instances. Would you like to see a more expansive notion of what this gender binary ought to be? Would you like to see room for a more nuanced way of identifying? And I'm not even so much thinking about like all of the complexities of our healthcare system yet. I'm just thinking about how could we think about gender identity in a way that would be less oppressive and less limiting for someone? Because it feels to me that the way in which the person is the sort of either or-ness of it, the absoluteness of it is a challenge. What would you just personally like to see? Like to see more kind of complexity and nuanced in the way these identities are described?
Well, I think an aha moment that I had, which I wrote an essay about, is that I've been doing various kinds of trans competency education for over a decade. I don't do it as much anymore, but certainly 10 years ago, I was very busy essentially teaching people to use, quote, the right language and to understand things about trans people's lives. And at the time, and I hope that we don't say this as much anymore, but at the time, we defined transness as someone whose gender identity doesn't match their sex assigned at birth. And usually when we would discuss this, we would then define sex assigned at birth and we would define gender identity. But we never sought to define those two words in the middle, doesn't match. And so I asked myself, what does it mean to say something doesn't match? So the image of like unmatched socks came to mind. And sometimes unmatched socks are like, someone is making a fashion statement. And sometimes they're kind of like an embarrassing thing that was an accident. And I wondered about how I had for so many years invited this as a primary metaphor to explain who I was.
Right.
And so I wondered, what does it mean for me to be acting like my identity is either, akin to a statement piece or akin to like an embarrassing mistake? Because that's kind of what comes to mind when I think about doesn't match. And yet this is kind of a primary narrative about transness. And so, if someone else says like, well, that's how I understand my trans identity, I think that's fine. But I have to wonder, what other things is this creating? And so in the same way, I think that it's wonderful that people are more aware of the difference between sex and gender identity, but they haven't gotten to the idea yet that like sex doesn't really exist in the sense of most of us don't know kind of what our chromosomes are. And like my sex on my driver's license might not be the same as on my passport. It's all just kind of very complicated. But culturally, it's difficult to hold space for complexity. And then people who live at that area of complexity are holding that burden.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking about the, as you compared it to the unmatched socks, I was thinking about one of the things we talk about a lot in the work we do at Wisdom Projects with young people is we talk about the difference between an asset narrative and a deficit narrative. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me you're describing a great example. And I've heard that definition before, and I honestly hadn't given it a lot of thought, but it's sort of a deficit narrative, right? It's like describing you by what's wrong with you is maybe a little harsh, but certainly like something that's not quite normal in a way is the kind of way it's described, right? So it is sort of a deficit narrative, right? As opposed to like an asset narrative.
Right. Yeah. And I feel that that tends to carry over in other ways. So for example, obviously I've absolutely experienced various challenges with accessing healthcare in various capacities, but also at the same time, because of that, I have a greater level of empowerment and critical thinking at this time in my life about how I access healthcare because of those experiences. So I've been able to advocate for myself in healthcare settings in ways that I probably would never have learned if I weren't trans.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it more broadly, it goes to the question about how we can look at a deeply held narrative that's very hard to see because we're sort of immersed in it. And if it's serving us, right, if we're in a position of power, which can mean a lot of different things in a lot of different ways, but if we are in some kind of a position of privilege and power in that narrative, it's harder to see it and critique it than if we are able to look at it from the perspective of kind of the margins. What would you say, and just going back to the question of healthcare, like if you could, and this is a big question, so I'm asking you to summarize something that's pretty vast, but if you could sort of describe what your experience in healthcare, both through your pregnancy and maybe more broadly, like what those experiences and what the kind of way that we have constructed this system that you describe, what does it teach us more broadly about the worldview that guides our society?
While I think about that one, I want to come back to one thing you said right before you asked me that question, which is about the question of if a narrative is serving us. I think often there's an assumption that a dominant narrative serves groups that have more cultural privilege. Mm-hmm. But I think that the skill of asking what narrative is going on here and is it serving me right now, and knowing, having a toolbox of how to answer that, and whether that's checking in somatically, whether it's looking at whether the narrative aligns with one's beliefs, is incredibly important. And I think it's a skill, it's a toolbox that needs to be cultivated to ask for all of us to constantly ask ourselves, like, what narrative am I in right now? And is it serving me right now? And how do I know? Do I know in my body? Do I know in my mind? Do I know from my values? I think this is an incredibly rich question. So I just want to comment on that. And then I will swing around to this other thing about healthcare. So what fascinates me is ways of knowing. How do we know that we know something? And in healthcare, especially in the past couple of decades, there's a real focus on evidence-based medicine, which means that we came to know something empirically through hopefully well-designed research, sometimes questionably designed research, and then we are bringing our clinical practice into alignment with that. But that is one way of knowing. There are other ways. You know, we can know by intuition, we can know by being told something by authority, we can know by faith, we can know by logic, and each of these has pluses and minuses. So culturally, we have privileged knowing through like science or like rationality over other types of knowing without necessarily contextualizing these ways of knowing and asking ourselves instead, what are the pluses and minuses of knowing something in this way versus that way? And what is the most appropriate way of knowing something in a given situation? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are, in that our epistemology teaches us something about our values, right? It's mm-hmm. not just sort of neutral, you know, it's right. Like there's a reason that we have faith in a particular way of knowing and sort of dismiss other ways of knowing.
Right.
So I want to take a quick break and we'll be back in a minute.
Our statement of intent. One, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and of transition. Two, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. Three, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. Four, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. Five, the crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. Six, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. Seven, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions. Rather, it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org.
I'm talking today to Finn Schubert, writer and public health professional, and we're exploring big questions about cultural narratives, stories we tell, and more specifically about some of Finn's own experiences through his pregnancy and experiences with our healthcare system. So I wanted to kind of like tie those things together, Finn, and ask you about something that you've really been exploring really deeply, which is narratives that we have about pregnancy itself. And how would you describe both the narratives that you kind of have been given about pregnancy and then maybe talk about how you depart from that and how you've come to understand maybe an alternative to that?
Sure. So after I got pregnant, the first thing, you know, everyone wants, you want to Google. And so there are all these apps and things like that. And they tell you week by week, like your baby is the size of a kumquat, your baby is the size of a Coke bottle. I'm fascinated by metaphors in general. So I was always fascinated by what they chose.
They were interesting choices. Yeah. But continue.
Yeah. There were some very interesting choices. And there's one app that's like designed for dads. And so these choices are like way more kind of masculine, like bag of chips. And then some of them choose like right. only fruits. So I'm already fascinated by that. Right. But what I came to notice was that I was being invited into this narrative where I was going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then I was going to kind of explode metaphorically. And then I was going to have sort of this like refractory period of bliss with my child. And I was like, well, this sounds kind of suspiciously like a male orgasm. I wonder if there are other ways to think about it. Because I've read this book, Meander, Spiral, Explode by Jane Allison, that was looking at narrative structures. And many of us have been taught a narrative structure that includes building up to a climactic moment and then having some sort of resolution. And she said, you know, that's not the only narrative structure. There are other ways to pattern or structure a narrative. And I think for me, I was uncomfortable with the idea that I was climbing a mountain or like, you know, just continuing to grow. And then I would reach this end point because I tend to be a little suspicious of linearity in general. And my friend, Mary Porter Kearns, showed me some wonderful pictures she had taken of sunflowers. And she depicted the entire life cycle of a sunflower. And I realized that I had so rarely seen a sunflower that's going to seed, where its petals are off and its, you know, its face is kind of to the ground and it's turning to seed. And I said, what if I expand the narrative lens? What if we don't turn the camera off right when the sunflower is reaching up to the sun? What if either the story of my pregnancy starts earlier than I thought it did, or it ends later than I thought it did, or it emphasizes different aspects on the fact that I'm physiologically getting bigger? You know, I would say that my energy levels during my pregnancy, for example, are not linear, but they might come in like waves or cycles. But yet that's not sort of the dominant way of looking at or evaluating what's going on in pregnancy. So I just started to open the question for myself about what my pregnancy story could look like and what other shapes it could have besides a narrative of linear growth.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's so kind of notion of linearity is so deeply ingrained. One thing that I'm really interested in is the notion of time and linear time and the way that we can buy and sell time. And I think that that's kind of connected to this sort of notion of a linear narrative. So say a little more though about your, because I want to get more into kind of the broader implications of that, but I'd like to hear more about ways that you have experienced that narrative. I almost said the word journey, but I'm not going to, but I how you've experienced this kind of nonlinear, if not in a straight line, or if not climbing on a mountain to a mountaintop, how would you describe the experience then? Like, what's the kind of shape of the journey for you?
It's hard to answer because I'm still on it, but I've been trying to at least invite the idea of other shapes. So, you know, instead of climbing a mountain, what if I'm sort of rafting down a lazy stream that makes twists and turns? That gives me a lot more spaciousness, right? In terms of feeling relaxed. And I think it's interesting that you mentioned this conversation about time and how we quantify time, because this has been a real exploration for me as well, because for me, my energy levels have not been what they used to be, and it's not linear and it's not as predictable. And so because of that, that's changed my relationship with time, because I used to be able to fairly predictably exchange a unit of time for a certain unit of work. And now I don't have that anymore. And in the same way, you know, before I got pregnant, I had a menstrual cycle. And that was a way that I measured time. And I found myself within the rhythm of a month. And then that totally went away. So now my relationship with sort of external clock time is all weird, because I can't predictably exchange units for work and energy in the same way. And my relationship with my own physiologic time has been kind of taken away. And so that has actually been a really challenging area for me to sort of invite new narratives. You know, it's okay to float down a river. We're not always climbing a mountain.
Yeah. As you were talking, you know, I was thinking of the two kind of experiences that I thought of were the experience of relationships, like human person-to-person relationships, and how, you know, we can sort of construct a linear narrative of a relationship, but it would be just that, it would be a construction. I mean, relationships are complex and fluid and, you know, climax and kind of wherever and randomly, not at like the end, you know what I mean? Maybe they do, but not necessarily, you know. And I was also thinking of like of the healing journey, like how healing happens in sometimes a maddeningly nonlinear way, how we can feel a sense of healing one day, and then we feel as though things are falling apart the next day, and maybe it ebbs and flows, and can't assume that things will move in a kind of linear and predictable way.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important point to emphasize, because we live in such a linear dominated culture, when people are having a healing experience that is not going in a linear way, which most of them really don't, then they feel like they're doing something wrong.
Yeah, yeah. It begins to feel like a failure, right?
Yeah. And so that's the other issue, is when we take away linearity, like, how do we know if we're a failure?
Mm. Yeah. I think of kind of like a human relationship, you know, like we could have, like, for example, like you could have a friendship that at some point dissolves, let's say.
Right.
Like, does that make the friendship a failure? Because like in terms of linear time, it sort of ended, you know, in a way that wasn't ideal. Or do we take from it the real moments of grace and beauty and love that happened at any point in time? So I think that it can bring up a lot of kind of like unnecessary harshness into the way we think about ourselves and our world.
Right.
Yeah. So we're almost, you know, sort of to the end here, but I wanted to kind of get from you, like, this is another like kind of really big question, but what is it that you see in this whole journey, like your experiences with healthcare, your experiences through your pregnancy, which is still not there, but you're in the middle of that. And like, and as you've thought about these narratives for pregnancy, what do you see as like the way we could look at the more, and we've touched on some ideas about this, but I'd like to hear more from you on it. Like, what do you see as kind of like how this narrative about pregnancy that's emerging for you, how do you see it, the broader implications of that for how we think of who we are and our place in the world?
I think one of the biggest questions that I've been invited into that has been really liberatory for me is the idea, what if I'm not doing it wrong? And I feel that we've covered a lot of different things that circle around this. You know, we talked about the idea that maybe I used to think that being trans meant not matching. I have had the experience within the last several months of being told I was literally wrong about what it says on my ID. I've been invited into many narratives through advertising or other educational materials for pregnant people that suggests that if I do the tiniest little thing, I've like ruined my child forever. And all of that feels like it's swirling around me. And yet, because it feels so antithetical to my experience, I've become able to really ask myself, well, what if I'm not doing it wrong? What if I don't need to have a linear measure of progress to feel good about myself? What if it's okay to rest, which I think is a really important and beautiful conversation that's emerging these days. So yeah, I would say this question, what if I'm not wrong?
Finn, I want to wish you the best, and you're going to give birth very soon, right? And probably by the time this airs, that will have happened. But I really want to settle into what you just said, because I think a lot as a parent myself, I think a lot about parenthood. And that's something you are kind of on the brink of. So I'm excited for you about that. But I'm also excited about the way you're talking about all these big questions. And the question that you pose, the sort of rhetorical question, what if I'm not doing it wrong, feels like a great way to sort of begin and end our conversation, but begin parenthood with. There are kind of 1,000 mistakes that you do that you'll make as a parent. Like before breakfast, right? Like you'll make every day. But that's really okay. It's not about kind of accomplishment or perfection or, you know, reaching the kind of summit. It's about settling into the experience, I think, in a way that's never quite perfect, but can still be beautiful. So I just want to thank you for all of your wisdom today and send you my great blessing on your next adventure.
Thank you so much.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.